honest, yes, it took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a shell shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their asses for 10 years.
All right, Conor, I want to start with the split season motion that was passed at Congress. It's the only Congress motion we're going to talk about because, you know, obviously it was last weekend and we did a good bit on it last Thursday. So the split season is passed. Now, this is what's kind of bothering me a little bit, is that All Ireland finals to move to July and be played on the 29th Sunday of the year, or the 30th if New Year's Day falls on a Sunday or whatever, right? So that's fine. So, like, I mean, I need to understand what exactly this split season is going to look like. I was under this kind of illusion that every county would then start their club championship on August the 1st and we would have a proper split season, as in inter-county until the end of July, club for the rest. And that goes across every county. That's what split season means to me. Now, the more I think about it and the more I inquired about it, none of that is set in stone at all. So, for example, any county is more than entitled to, if they get knocked out of the championship in June, start their club championship in June. Any county is entitled to start it in July if they want. There's nothing to prevent them from doing that. And we know that's probably what will happen. If that happens, Conor, number one, club players in those counties will never know when their championship starts, because you never know how far your county's going to go. So they have no certainty on when their club championship starts. And number two, if one county starts in June, another county starts in August, there's a huge discrepancy in when they finish up their championships and when the provincial championships start. So I was really disappointed. I went searching for this, like, was there any kind of, you know, attachment to this motion to kind of, you know, specify when club championships need to start? And there's not. And I got some confirmation from Croke Park that level of planning hasn't started yet, and they see it being up to counties to strike their own balance. I don't know, Conor. I can see this not being what we hoped it would be in the future.
Yeah, I suppose it's a little disappointing when you have the good news of the split season, which I think everybody, we certainly spoke about how we advocated for it, Willie, and I think a lot of people would have been glad to see it introduced in Congress. And then maybe to find out that when you drill down a bit into it, as you have, that there's a lot of kind of ambiguity there, and there's maybe a lack of clarity about what it will involve. So I suppose the way I come at it is that, like, I'm the same as you in that, like, if you have a start date for club championships across the board, the one thing that really annoyed club players, for example, was that lack of knowledge when, you know, to be able to plan their season, right? So granted, some counties are going to go out earlier than others, for example. But if you, I don't know, and maybe individual counties will come back and say there's huge problems if they're not able to start their championship for a certain date. But I know if I'm a club player and I'm told at the start of the year that, like, well, listen, the club championship is definitely starting on the 1st of August, for example, as you said, and then these are your dates, absolutely set in stone. Do you know what I mean? This is going to happen no matter what. There'd be a certain amount of comfort in that you can plan around. And then, like,
well, we actually thought that was the whole premise of the split season. As it turns out now, that the split season for every county that hasn't made the Super Eights, you know, which is 24 counties, nothing really changes with this split season because they'll have been out before July anyway. So, like, this split season is being championed by everybody, but it's not, I don't think it might not end up being what people had hoped.
Yeah, no. From what you said there, like, exactly, it doesn't seem that might be the case. But, like, I was kind of looking at it from a kind of a point of view where if there was some sort of uniformity across the board and everybody could agree on that, and then, like, if you go out earlier, like, what's to stop you maybe from playing? You know, every county has some sort of kind of pre-season to a degree. With,
well,
like,
your club league should be run. And your club league can be played in June and July, because some people would have a fairly legitimate concern. Oh, your county's out in June and now your club players are sitting idle in July, you know, and having to wait till August. That's fine. But play your county league and plan it so that your county league is finishing up in the first or second week in July, and then a 2 week break, and then championship. That's not that hard. I'm just a little bit concerned that that's not what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, the one thing I'd say about that, Willie, is then are you not denying, in some counties, are you not denying county players being able to play in their leagues? And that there'll be certain counties where, you know, their championship status or, you know, are tied into how they go in the league and stuff like that.
That's the case now. Like, you won't fix that. It's either a split season. It's either a split season on inter-county and club championship. I think that's the best compromise everybody's going to be able to find here. Club league is enough to keep club players ticking over, you know, May, June, July, and then everybody start their championship. I don't know. I think that's just how I saw the split season, and maybe I was being a little bit naive, and I just saw when it was passed, I went looking to see, you know, have they specified this now so that it would be uniform across the whole country? And they didn't. And what's really kind of bothering me here, Connor, is that when you think about all these issues that could arise from this, wouldn't it be nice if the club players had a voice and had a union? Well, they're not going to have that because the CPA are too busy after clapping themselves on the back. They're after taking credit for fixing the fixtures when, let's be honest, even though I was a huge supporter of the CPA, they made little or no difference. The only thing that changed the split season was the unique year we had last year with the coronavirus. And they're after disbanding. It's like, our work here is done. Like, yeah. I mean, this is just beyond belief. There's plenty of issues going to arise out of this split season. And they've vanished off after, I'll read out a bit in a minute, but they've vanished after kind of congratulating themselves.
I don't think it's fair to say that they took credit for it, Willie, to be fair. They said this week that, like, they achieved their ambition. There was no kind of, didn't say that their ambition came about solely because of them. Do you know what I mean? Like,
wait a minute. Well, I'll give it. Here's Micheál Briody who yeah. said, our executive changed at times, but over the years, we were singular in our objective. We achieved our objective. No, you didn't achieve your objective. Your objective was achieved due to a really unique year. The GAA had been kind of dismissing the CPA nearly every single thing they tried. And again, I would have been critical of the GAA in that. I just don't understand why did the CPA, here they said in their statement, 4 years ago, we presented the split season to senior officials in Croke Park and we were told it would never work and that we were asking too much for the club. Like, I mean, I was talking about the split season 8 years ago. Like, I mean, this wasn't something they just brought to Croke Park and suggested, you know, I don't know. And then for them to have this big meeting and say our work here is done, for me, I didn't really like it.
Well, I'll quote you another line. So, Willie, I think this could have been me all as well. And he said, we've always said it is about what is right, not who is right. So eventually, like, the way I looked at it was that ultimately their target was achieved, maybe not necessarily by them, because let's be honest about it. The reason we came to a split season is because of it was a pandemic that, you know, caused the unique circumstances of last year that led to a split season. Everybody realized it was brilliant and we should do this on a more permanent basis. But I think it's unfair to say that the CPA took credit for it. I was usually in favor of what the CPA...
But do you not think that disbanding after it happened, it's like, you know, I thought that kind of... I don't know.
That they've consistently tried to raise issues at a national level, for example. Whereas we've just talked about it now, is that the arrangement and organization of club structures is going to, as it always has, but, like, you know, it's going to be at the behest of individual county boards. So I suppose the CPA probably think that they don't want to get involved in local politics. I don't know, but
they were getting involved in local politics, and they had some issues with county boards having that autonomy and for these fixtures not to be centralized, and all these issues still remain. All of these issues still remain. You could have a club player in Tipperary or wherever, any county that's knocked out early, they might not be in the hurling, that starts their club championship in June and now they're finished it in mid-September, and the teams that play in the All-Ireland final aren't finished till mid-October, and that's when the provincial championships start. So one county has a 1 month lag until that happens and the other doesn't. And instead of centralising the fixtures and the CPA saying, right, this is a huge positive development for the club player, but we're not done yet. Now, they won't be overburdened with work because, like, I mean, this isn't coming into effect, you know, until maybe not next year or the year after, depending on the championship structure. And, like, I mean, if the CPA think that that's their job done, that the fixtures are fixed, they're not. It's just a split season has been voted in. And like I said, for about 24 counties, it'll make no posy odds unless this is streamlined and every county has a uniform start date.
Yeah, and surely there's more reason now for there to be a uniform start date. Well, because as we talked about last week, which was passed at Congress, is that now senior championships, senior club championships have to be limited to a maximum of 16 teams. So surely now it's a case where, well, if the GAA were to look at that sensibly and say, well, listen, every club championship is exactly the same. It can't be beyond more than 16 teams. So why not get a uniform date? Anyone who's given out about Exeter and Championship earlier, play your leagues, play your divisional cups. But in terms of club championships, this is the way it should go. It just ensures more kind of uniformity across the board. And all I will say about the CPA as well is that for years, Woolley, for as long as they've been in existence, they have met with, you know, I would say indifference to bordering on outright hostility from the GAA. And also, like, to be honest, let's be honest about it, a lack of engagement from the vast majority of the club population who, you know, you had club players for years given out, then they had a voice in the CPA and a lot of people didn't want to know about it. Do you know what I mean? Like I had a lot of sympathy for the CPA in that, and that, like, do you know, a lot of the stuff they put out, loads of surveys, they kind of made their voice felt. They were quite actually aggressive in their dealings toward the GAA at times. And I think that they didn't get I didn't think they got enough engagement from the club player that they deserved. So they're probably weighing that all up as well, Willie, and thinking if they were to continue to cause hassle, the GAA are probably looking at it and thinking, you got your split season. They probably didn't get it because of the CPA, as we said, it was probably because of the pandemic. But will you ever just go away? And they probably think that they could do without that hassle. I don't know. That's just kind of where I'm coming at it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that if club players need a voice, and that's what they said that they were, I think that there's definitely use for them. I don't mind them saying, look, this is great, whatever. I just don't know why they disbanded. I don't know. Like, I mean, let's wait and see how this plan pans out. Like, do they reform again when everything, you know, starts going to shit and it doesn't work out the way we thought? Anyways, we'll wait and see. Maybe Croke Park will issue an instruction to county boards and to honour the split season. But the word I got from Croke Park, and this is the word I always get from Croke Park, is it's up to each individual county board. And we know what each individual county board, you know, we know the way they deal with things a lot of the time. They do things whatever way they want and whatever way it's always been done. So look, we'll wait and see. Anyways, I would just love if the CPA hadn't decided that their work here is done, because I don't think it is. Anyways, move off that one. New GAA president was unveiled, Larry McCarthy. Interesting one with Larry McCarthy is that he hasn't come through the traditional route of first being like a provincial, maybe a county board chairman, then provincial council chairman, and then the president. So he might have a fresh look. It almost compare to, you know, an outside manager coming into the county and, you know, none of that kind of old favoritism going on, you know, a fresh look at things. And maybe that's what Larry McCarthy will give. Like, I mean, his background is that he's an associate professor in the department management at, Seton Hall University in New Jersey. So he specializes in sports marketing and management. And it does look like he's very qualified, and I like the fact that he's specializing in sports marketing and management, because we see a lot of counties now seeing the value in having a commercial, you know, marketing manager running that kind of side of things. I'm a little bit excited to see what he'll do. I'm going to have a completely open mind on Larry McCarthy, and let's see how he works out.
Yeah, everything I've seen and heard about Larry McCarthy to date has been great, Willie, including, I think most recently, we might get to it, but it's about kind of getting kids back in the pitch in Ireland, having been kind of absent for so long and have not been able to train, etc. But just in terms of the
tradition. But just so you get on that, like, I mean, that was very impressive, I thought, from him. He said, I would make an appeal to the government that once the schools are reopened, to let the, I don't like that word, kids, let the children back to playing in the clubs. We did it safely last year, both in running club activity as well as the cool camps. It was highly regulated and done very effectively. You would hope someone would see the benefit of allowing us back. Is that just me from memory? Is that a little bit different than John Horan saying we're going to follow the experts and we're not going to do anything until we're told? He's appealing to the government, let us back.
Yeah, well, it's different from John Horan that, like, the pandemic was only maybe 2 months old when John Horan was dealing with this initially. You remember the Sunday game interview, and he kind of changed tune then not long after that.
A little bit, yeah.
Like, in fairness to, as I said, like, everything I've heard from Larry McCarthy to date, I've liked, you know what I mean? And, like, you mentioned there, the kind of didn't take the traditional route, which I think is brilliant. Like, I think too much is probably made of, like, I know a lot goes into GA administration, but too much is maybe made of the experience that people in these roles have. Whereas there's a danger of getting maybe being too involved in it for too many years, and that you're not as open to change as a result, because it's just the environment that you're used to. So I don't think he's afraid to ruffle feathers either. Willie, I think, like, he's had a couple of digs at the GPA in the past and stuff like that too. So which again is no harm. So yeah. And just on the sports marketing thing, I think that could make him more qualified for what he actually has to do than any GA administrator that's been there in the past. I've already heard him spoke quite well on kind of TV rights and stuff like that, which he'd have a background in through his role in that university in New Jersey. So yeah, everything I've heard today that I liked. So let's hope he keeps that up.
Yeah, and he likes my restructure proposal, and this is mine. I want to keep reminding everybody on every show that I possibly can that the flip season model, where you play the provincials first and then the league as the All-Ireland Championship, that is my idea, 100%. I was the first person that came up with this, and he said, if we adopt one of the new formats proposed by the Fixtures Review Committee, proposed by me, and then proposed by the Fixtures Review Committee, which will be debated at Special Congress later in the year, we will trial it and we'll see if we're happy with it, and we will adopt it on a longer term basis. One of the options links the Alliance Leagues to the Championship. It would appear to have the potential to make the Championship more competitive, at least in the early rounds. It has the potential to alleviate the issues of non-competitive games which exist in some of our football competitions. Again, like, nothing major there, but look, acknowledging what we need and that he's open to it. And what I always love is, listen, let's try, let's see, do we like it? And if we don't, then we won't do it. And I kind of like that that attitude. So yeah, Larry, we've got an open mind with you, and we'll hopefully get you on the show as soon as you want to. There's an open invitation there anyways. So Connor, she's only 23. And this year she made a comeback from a cruciate knee injury. She scored 5-17 in 3 games in the Championship, including a brilliant goal against Dublin in the semi-final. And she's just won the Player of the Year. It's Amy Mackin, and she joins us on the line now. Did I fit everything into that intro, Amy?
Yeah, you did, yeah.
What a year for you, winning Player of the Year. Like, I mean, considering without COVID hitting, you probably would have just wrote off that year.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the big thing. We were grateful to have a season in itself. Obviously, we went into the season a bit unknown about how we'd perform ourselves and how every other county was getting on because of the year or the few months prior to that and the lockdown and stuff. But yeah, it was a good year for Armagh in general, and I was lucky to put on a good few performances myself. But it's something that we'll take in the next year and something that we have to build on.
So when you were going through all your rehab during lockdowns, like, at what point were you thinking, geez, I actually have a chance of making this year now?
Yeah, well, it was just coming to the end of the lockdown when they started giving dates about playing football, and it probably worked out in my favour that the club season was played first, so it gave me a bit of time then to build up my confidence and get the first few games over with before going into the heavy county stuff. So it probably worked out in my favour, and yeah, it was probably close to the end of the lockdown where I realised I might get a shot of playing a championship, because beforehand when I got injured I was sort of unsure what way or when I'd come back or what part of the season on a normal season I'd come back. So I was kind of lucky that way.
Talk to us about the cruciate injury, because it happened in that brilliant win against Cork last year, and you obviously missed the All-Ireland quarterfinal against Mayo. Like, I mean, did you play on with that cruciate injury? Because I saw you came off at half-time.
Yeah, no, I was just changing direction, and I felt a pop and I heard a crack. So I tried to play on, but the physio didn't give me any chance. I probably wouldn't have been able to either. But it was a mixed emotions kind of day, obviously, because I was delighted for the team to get the win. But obviously, it was just disheartening to pick up a bad injury. But listen, I'm the other side of it now, so I don't want to look back too much on it now.
Yeah, no, well, that's true, because you're very young to get a serious injury like that, I suppose. Like, how were you in the rehab? Because that's it's a long road back.
Yeah, well, I didn't look too far ahead. I took each stage as it came, and it was just about ticking off the boxes and getting the work done. But I had two friends that had done it as well, so I'd heard about the injury, but then you hear about stories of people not returning or not playing football ever again, so you do have them thoughts. But it was just about recovering after the surgery and getting as much work in then and getting on the pitch when I could and just taking it step by step. I probably didn't look too far ahead, and I never looked at my comeback until I was on the pitch. So it sort of was just a step-by-step process.
Right, you're lucky you had those two friends then, because from my experience of being injured, you're kind of like the forgotten person until you're back training with everybody.
Yeah, and that's probably as well. The lockdown probably helped, you know, because I had less trainings where I had to watch or matches that I had to watch sitting on the sidelines. So
yeah.
At that point, even though I was going through a rehab, there was our whole team was trained on their own, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't so much a big difference.
Yeah, everyone was living the injured kind of routine.
Yeah, the only thing was my program was different to what the rest of my teammates were doing, but it was the same sort of scenario that we were all in.
Come here, explain to me, I'm reading this and I find it hard to believe, Amy, that on your comeback game against Cross McGlen, your team are losing, you come on at half-time, your club team that is, and you score 8 goals in the second half. Now, I need you to confirm this is true, because I find, how is that possible?
Yeah, no, it is true. I think a lot of them were put on the plate for me. I was a bit surprised myself, but it was a lot of the work was done before I got the ball and had to put it in the net. So it was a good game to come back in. And yeah, I was only allowed a half, 30 minutes at that point, because that was only my second game back.
Well, talk about doing the world of good for your confidence.
Yeah, that's it. That's probably where the confidence stemmed from, yeah.
So that's a goal every 4 minutes. Like, I mean, how does this happen? Like, I mean, are you completely dominating the game in midfield? How, like, I mean, is it a domination, or how? I can't picture how 8 goals can be scored in a half of football.
Well, I'm not too sure either. Sort of, it all happened. It was very fast. It was a bit of a blur. It was just one after the other. But yeah, as I say, a lot of it was just pulling the plate for me. I just had to tap it in. But I'm not sure, whatever changed at halftime, the whole team sort of lifted as well, so we got on top of the game.
Yeah, I didn't score 8 goals in my entire club and inter-county career, never mind 8 goals in a half of football. Come here, has anyone ever told you you have a very similar style to Jamie Clark?
No, not really, no. It's probably because we're both left-footed or something, yeah. I'd say.
Yeah, when I saw some of your highlights, it was Jamie Clark and James O'Donoghue who kind of popped into my head for comparisons.
I'd say I'm a long way off that their type of calibre now.
Jeez, I don't think so. Jeez, I genuinely don't think so. Like, I mean, your skill levels are off the charts. Sidestep, the dummy bounce, you must do an awful lot of work on that.
Yeah, well, I think there's two brothers in my house, so we would have watched a lot of football. In particular, obviously, we would have watched the men, Armagh men's team and the Armagh women's team when we were younger, because they would have had such a great team. And
yeah,
we always remember the likes of Ronan Clark and Stephen McDonald. So you would have been watching their football matches, and in between half times, you would have been out in the garden practicing. So it started when I was young, you know, just we practice every day. But you didn't know it was practice, you know, it was just fun play that we did at home. But it's probably all them hours spent in the garden that you have to look back and think that's probably where we started developing them.
So, like, I mean, when you were out there, because I was wondering, was it a specific coach maybe that taught you, you know, all the skills you have? Or is it just seeing a dummy bounce on the television and then going out and practicing it?
Yeah, well, obviously coaches do help you, but I think them types of skills are probably just watched. I watched a lot of football matches, so seeing other county players doing it and just trying to instinctively learn it, and I suppose probably if it is just a lot of instinct. So just the game against Dublin with the dummy bounce, that was just instinctive to do that. I didn't think too much about it, but yeah, obviously it's a lot of work from when we were younger to practice the skills and bring them into our game and develop them even further.
Well, that's the thing. The goal against Dublin, like, I mean, there was no goal on when you got it there, right? So, like, I mean, I don't know, did you wait for the defender to kind of sell a little bit, show it one way, and then the minute the dummy bounce is done, you think a goal is on? Like, when are you thinking goal?
Yeah, I think when the dummy bounce was done, I just thought I had to go for a goal. I think it was at a certain point of the game that we probably needed a goal. You know, when you look at the game itself, if it had happened in the first half, I might have just stuck it over the bar. But as soon as I got the ball, I was thinking, before the dummy bounce, I was thinking I have to go for a goal. And then, obviously, with the dummy bounce, it opened up a wee bit more space for me, and I just had to try to put it in the back of the net. Sometimes it can go wide, so...
Well, from your highlights, I know highlights only show the goals. It doesn't look like you put too many of them. Is it true you used to go for goals an awful lot? And like, I mean, you're not going for them as much now. Maybe a bit more variety into your play.
Probably, obviously, when you're younger, you probably do. It's different. Senior county football is a lot different to when you're playing under 14s, under 16s, or minors. Even there's less space in a game and. You notice that as you step up into the senior category within the county especially. I think it's probably just you don't get as many opportunities in games now because it's probably a wee bit more defensive. But I think when the opportunity comes, you have to take them. And I think it's probably what I have to learn a bit as well, maybe seeing an opportunity more and just maybe there is more opportunities to go for goal. But probably over the last few years when we were maybe lower in the leagues, Division 3 or whatever, and there probably was more opportunities for goals, so I took them.
Yeah, no, well, that's true. Obviously, at the top level, and you need to be unpredictable as well. Like, I mean, you know, you have to mix it up. Your movement is excellent as well. Like, you're not a typical corner forward or full forward. You kind of have license to go wherever you want.
Yeah, no, well, I think that's probably what we learnt as well and what we practice a lot in training. It's never usually the first ball that you're or the first movement that you're looking to pass. It's usually the second, or sometimes you have to do a third movement. So I think that's key as a forward, is always moving, because if you stand still, it's going to be very easy to defend. So I try to anyway keep moving and just try to make it as hard for defenders as I can.
Well, that's the thing. But when I think of the likes in, I'm going to apologise for keep using comparisons to the men's game, but that's kind of
no, you're dead on.
I mean, I look at the likes of Bernard Brogan, who'd be known goal scorer, and his movement is very limited. You know, he doesn't usually go outside his scoring area, whereas you're actually a goal scorer that kind of floats into a lot of different areas.
Yeah, and I think it's probably just looking at the space as well. I think we work on that in training, is sometimes a half forward might end up in the full forward line, and it's just about reading the game and probably being more versatile between all six forwards, you know. So it's just about reading the game, and if you see someone else in that space, you know there's going to be space somewhere else, and you just have to make the movements.
Yeah, exactly. So you're from a GAA Mad family, like you said, practicing out in the backyard and after matches. Your two brothers, they're both on the Armagh senior panel now, and your sister is obviously converted centre back now on the women's team.
Yeah, it's a big GAA family, and it's been instilled from our dad mainly, but my mum's heavily involved in it too, and was heavily involved in it. But our dad would have took us to every Armagh match up and down the country, and any club match, so we would have been watching it a lot, and he would have been managing our club team, so we would have been always down in the football field. And yeah, as you say, it was just always a football in our hand, but it was something we loved, so it was never a chore as such, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, exactly. Here, come here. You must have loved your sister's move from full forward to centre back. So instead of hogging the ball, you want, now she's giving you all the balls.
Yeah, it's funny actually, because she would have played club football. She would have been playing full forward or half forward, and gradually now she was in midfield, and as well this year, then she got in a half back role. But I think that just probably sums her up. She's very versatile, and she can defend as well as she can come up and score. So she scored a few points this year. And yeah, I think there's probably a bit of telepathy there between the two of us. We've been playing long enough and we know each other's game. So I know sometimes when she gets the ball, I know where she's going to put it, and she probably knows where I'm going to be.
Knows where you're going to run as well. Listen, the whole narrative around Armagh ladies football, it's on the up. Like, I mean, you have a very professional setup. You have the first ever ladies organisation to play on their own facilities. You have a pitch, a centre of excellence. You have a fundraising wing, Friends of Armagh Ladies. I'm sure you all, you know, dug in to help fundraise for it. But like, I mean, you know, it must be a nice feeling to be on that kind of journey.
Yeah, definitely, and it's very positive at the minute. There's a lot going on, and I think for players, when we see a lot of the work that goes on behind the scenes with our county board and especially our chairperson, like the amount of work they do, it makes you appreciate it and appreciate what you've got, and it makes you want to work harder when you get on the pitch and do well for your county. But yeah, it's very positive for Armagh with the pitch and stuff. It's good to have a base for our training, because prior to that, over the last few years, you could be waiting an hour before training to find out where you're actually training. So it's very good to have a base, and now hopefully we're progressing it on to get lights so that we can use it on the evenings as well. So it's going well and we're going in the right direction, but we can't stand still. We have to keep pushing ourselves and keep going further.
Yeah, no, is the whole thing fit? You obviously need the lights, like you said. Is the Centre of Excellence finished?
No, well, the next stage is to get the lights installed, and then I think it will be change rooms. There is change room facilities at the minute, but they're talking about building a improved complex sort of thing. But if we get it lights on it, that will be a big benefit to us.
Yeah.
So that we can use it in the dark evenings as well.
Yeah, no, listen, it's fantastic that you've moved it on. Like you said, not knowing where you're going to train an hour before training, like, I mean, that must be absolutely demoralising.
Yeah, definitely. And it was probably a struggle there for a few years. But I can see the improvements that's being made as well. So it's good not to have that problem. And
yeah,
hopefully there's more counties within the women's game that will take that stride as well.
Yeah. Do you think your LGFA is obviously very progressive and is doing fantastic work for you? Because I've always been of the opinion that why doesn't the ladies game just come under the GAA umbrella and you wouldn't have to pay to use GAA facilities because you're Gaelic footballers and, you know, hurlers, yeah. Camogie players anyways. I don't know, do you have any thoughts on that? Like, I think the fact you have your own grounds is brilliant, but I'd quite like for you to use the same grounds your brothers use.
Yeah. Well, it's something that it's probably for other people to discuss, but I don't see why there would be a problem. But I haven't really thought too much about it. Obviously, yeah, it'd be nice all to be under the one code and to be working together. Yeah, other people maybe have to look at that more in depth, and I'd have to look at that more in depth to not really know what the pros and cons would be, but I could only think that it would be a positive move. But yeah, I think it's probably up to more higher up people than me.
Yeah, well, that's true. I'm not going to suck you into that debate, Amy. You've enough to be worried about. Come here, you're a very, very good soccer player as well. Have you given that up to concentrate on the GAA, or are you still playing a bit?
No, well, I was playing up until I got injured, so at the minute now that I've returned, I haven't got back to it yet, but it's probably something I'll think about maybe over the next month or two to maybe think about getting back. But it's very hard as well to do the both, because county football is very professional now, and it's getting even more professional, even though it's an amateur sport. It takes up a lot of your time and stuff like that. So it's something maybe I'll look into the future, but at the minute, not really, no.
Right, okay.
I do miss it though sometimes.
Yeah, I presume you're a striker in that, or on the wing.
Yeah, striker or left wing usually. It just depends. I've played both. But I did enjoy the soccer, and I watch it a lot still at the minute. So
yeah,
it's something that I always enjoyed.
And you've played international.
Yeah, I did, yeah. I got a few caps and stuff like that. And that was a good experience for me to play at that level and play against top countries in the Euros and the World Cup qualifiers.
Right, okay, fantastic. So how are you managing this lockdown before I let you go, Amy? You know, it's a lot better than the last one, because you obviously aren't rehabbing an injury. And in fairness, in Northern Ireland, there's some bit of a roadmap out of it, whereas we don't have anything down here.
Yeah, well, we got a roadmap there yesterday, so there's a wee bit of a positive outlook now that hopefully it'll not be too long before we can start training collectively. But we're probably still a few weeks off maybe that. But at the minute, yeah, we're just, even though I'm not rehabbing, we're still doing as much work as we can, and we're getting programs sent out. So it's a lot easier now that I have Blaheen as well to train with, and the boys are obviously training as well, so it's a wee bit easier to get motivated and stuff like that. But it can be hard some days, but you just have to get on with it and just roll with the times, and hopefully there'll be a brighter future in the next few months.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. Come here, Amy, thanks very much for taking the call, and best of luck for the year.
No problem at all, thank you.
Yeah, great stuff from Amy there. And like, in very interesting that Armagh LGFA are the only county in the whole country that have their own grounds. So fair play to them for that. It's very impressive. And they have a GoFundMe page, you know, to raise money to continue on that good work. So if you search for Armagh GAA Development Fund, You'll find that GoFundMe page if you want to give them some money and help them finish the Centre of Excellence and the floodlights, like Amy was mentioning there. So, like, great work out of them, isn't it? It's a weird one, Conor, because, like, I mean, Amy didn't want to get into it, but at the same time, my argument always is they shouldn't have to build their own grounds. They should be part of the GAA and use GAA grounds. But it is very impressive that they've gone down the route of going, here, we want our own base. We can't always be depending, you know, on knowing an hour before training where we're supposed to be going.
Yeah, and our willing, as Amy spoke about there, and as you spoke about there with the GAA, with the GoFundMe page, to kind of just you know, do something, think outside the box, for want of a better phrase, to kind of fund these things, especially at these times when kind of funds are a bit scarce. But yeah, fair play to her in terms of the counties having their own grounds in the LGFA. You know, I think that might be a debate for another day, but I'm sure we'll revisit it again, will we?
Yeah, definitely. She was mentioning the vaccine rollout up in the north, and Oisín McConville has been talking about this, and he's been pushing for the six counties to go back before the rest of the country. And like he was on BBC talking about this, and he said 25%. Now, before I say this, it is kind of very unusual for a man from South Armagh wanting the six counties to be treated differently to the rest of the. So listen, we'll have to take this. And the way I look at it is, Oisín is not going to look a gift horse in the mouth at this stage. And he said on BBC, he says 25% of the association shouldn't be punished because we don't have our ducks in a row elsewhere. He's right, Conor. Like, I mean, if the six counties are in, in the UK, and the vaccine is being flying out there, and if they're given the green light a month before we are in the south, why would they have to sit around when it's safe to go back? The government that they're, you know, in the jurisdiction they're under has allowed them go back. It just seems beyond belief that they wouldn't be allowed back.
Yeah, I think as Brian McAvoy kind of changed his tune on that a little bit since, talking about the clubs in particular, I think, just from what I was reading.
Yeah, but it'd have to be club though, Conor, because it would be an unfair advantage for inter-county to go back first, because obviously the National League will be starting back, and that would be unfair to allow the six county teams, you know, a month's training ahead of the rest. But for clubs, like, we won't have club championship until August. So, like, I mean, what's the 3 or 4 weeks difference going to make at that stage?
No, I absolutely don't think there's any difference. And just because the North has been better at rolling their vaccine out than we have, there's, you know, that's the club players up there shouldn't suffer because we're a bit slower. You know, why not get them back? There are exceptional circumstances here to let the club players back particularly. But the only thing I take issue, Woolly, would be, you know, not letting the inter-county training back. It would be unfair, but, like, you have greater faith than me, I think, than the willingness of inter-county managers to abide by that. I'd say they'd probably the way around it. If inter-county players are back training with their clubs and the county season is coming first, I just think the county managers will probably find a way in getting their you know, county players back training before everybody else as well.
Yeah. But do you think they do that anyways, when it's been told that we saw Down doing it, we saw Cork doing it, and that's when it wasn't safe? So I could imagine the six the counties will have them training when it's safe to do so. They'll still get that leg up. But unless you just allow underage, you know, up until minor under 20 back.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I mean, like, as you said, if they were willing to do it when it wasn't safe to do so, and kind of made a case even when they were kind of sanctioned that, you know, they appealed against the bans. Maybe they appealed against them being too severe as opposed to appeal against the bans in the first place. They'd be willing to do it when it's a lot safer to do so. And they wouldn't be looked down as, it wouldn't be looked down on as badly if inter-county teams were training while club teams were training as well. But that's up to the policing of the inter-county training session, you know, training sessions up in those counties for the GAA not to allow it to go ahead. But I would see then a situation where we'll get more speculation about inter-county teams being allowed to go back, and us not being allowed, but back training when other teams aren't allowed, and it being particularly unfair where county season is coming back first and you're very close to that season. And then you'd probably have county teams more inclined down in the Republic where they're not allowed to go back to maybe try and take a chance and go back earlier if everyone else is doing it. So, but again, it's just an issue for down the line if club players in the North are allowed to go back.
Yeah, I can't see it happening personally. I think they should be allowed, but I can't see the GAA allowing six counties back before everybody else. I think they'll just go with the All Ireland approach like they have been doing. But it's still very, very, very unfair for, you know, if it's safe in the six counties, for at least, you know, with the vaccination and everything, for them to just be sitting there locked out of their own GA grounds. It just, for me, it makes absolutely no sense. Kevin Walsh has been talking. He's released an autobiography, and he talks about it. A couple of the headlines out of it was Dublin's unfair advantage in Croke Park, and I thought that was fair enough for him to say it. I think that's a no-brainer. Everybody will agree with that, outside of people in Dublin, for some reason, won't accept home advantage as an advantage, even though the world of sport acknowledges that playing at home is more of an advantage to playing away. They play all their league games in Croke Park, most every championship game bar one, and they try to argue that that's not their home ground, and they try to argue that their home ground is a ground, Parnell Park, that they never play on. It's the most bizarre argument I've ever come across, but anyways, we'll leave that to them. But the one that kind of annoyed me here with Kevin Walsh was a little bit, he's talking about Pádraig Joyce, and it's this chip on the shoulder of these defensive managers, and I just can't understand it. Like, I mean, he says in it, and I quote, "Now I understand it's a new manager." He's talking about Pádraig Joyce now. "Now I understand it's a new manager, a new story, but in actual fact, the old narrative continues. The big bad wolf has been replaced and Joyce will have Galway zipping it around without a care for defensive solidity and structure." Now, I don't understand what the issue here is, because, like, Kevin Walsh has got some big issues about being called a defensive manager. He is a defensive manager. Like, man, he had Paddy Talley in there, and his players used to retreat ahead of the ball, wait around the 45-metre line, and try and counter-attack. I don't understand with these defensive managers. Why don't they just say, these are the tactics I use. I'm proud of these tactics. It's almost like deep down, these GA men are ashamed of what they're doing, and they won't kind of accept it. Because he goes on, he says, "Yet it was Shane Walsh giving away a penalty in the first National League game against Monaghan in 2020. Conor Gleeson saved Conor McManus's kick and Galway won by a point." Like, everybody knows that Pádraig Joyce made Shane Walsh his captain, and he made him his full forward, and he was their target man. Shane Walsh was not instructed to defend. Maybe he had to chase back against his man, where we know full back lines just take off. But such a thing to say, to try and make out that Pádraig Joyce started off, you know, with instructing Shane Walsh to be back, giving away penalties. And then he continues on, "Pádraig is not a foolish man. He'll bring his own strengths and philosophies into the mix, of course, rightly so. But he knows that to win in All-Ireland, you have to be set up well. And I wasn't surprised that he didn't throw all the baby out with the bathwater. That the arc defence, for example, is still in use to a large degree." Again, trying to compare his tactics with Pádraig Joyce's tactics. Why is he doing that, Conor? Like, why can't he just say, right, Pádraig has a different approach to me. I went pretty defensive. I thought that was the best way we get out of the best, you know, tactics to get the best out of the players, and own it. Why do all these defensive managers try to pretend that they're actually attack minded managers?
Yeah, I don't know. I think in Kevin Welsh's case, for example, I think there's a little bit of a chip on the shoulder there. Is if he thinks he probably isn't getting enough acknowledgement from where he brought Galway, from where they were, to where they were when he started, to where they were when he finished. So, like, Kevin Walsh came into a team that absolutely needed that defensive solidity. They were whipping boys in Connacht for years before he came in. Then he turns them around to the point that, like, Mayo couldn't beat them for years. Now, Galway came unsuck, you know, they came unsuck against Roscommon a couple of times, came unsuck against Tipperary, I think, in All-Ireland semi-final, and most notably came unsuck in that All-Ireland semi-final against Dublin, where they got hammered because of Galway's limitations, because they were a defensive team. So I think that kind of comes into it as well. And Kevin Welsh is probably hearing talking Galway last year, particularly about how brilliant it was to see Pádraig Joyce return with this free-flowing attacking philosophy, whereas he did what he had to. But, like, I don't know why he doesn't acknowledge that he was a defensive team, because of course he was a defensive team. And he saw Galway, you know, contain Mayo enough with tactics that worked against Mayo, but they were defensive tactics. Do you know, they were absolutely defensive tactics. But I'd say that comes into a way. I think that's it, that there's maybe not enough acknowledgement from that he turned Galway into a far hardened outfit than what they were.
Yeah.
And maybe sick of the fact that Pádraig Joyce is seen as the Messiah, and that's down to his background in Galway, as well as the philosophy that he's come in with, and that maybe it's not fair on him and kind of the work he did in Galway for the years that he was in there.
I think it wasn't as defensive in his last year as it was at the start. He did try to maybe, you know, leave more forwards up than he did initially, And like, I remember they played Kildare in Newbridge in the Super 8s, and you know, it was a very, very good footballing display where Ian Burke, Shane Walsh, and I'm not sure Comer was there, but like, I mean, they left three forwards up, and it, you know, they were kick passing it in, and it looked really good. And then, you know, they might play someone else, and they're reverting back, you know, to dropping back into these zones. But I don't know. Like, I mean, I do accept that Pádraig Joyce against Mayo in the Connacht final potentially played a sweeper, which is unusual for him, bringing back a forward. But you know, Kevin Walsh, when he continued on, kind of pointed to the hammering they took against Mayo, saying, you know, that that was gung-ho. Whereas the same gung-ho kind of philosophy hammered Tyrone the game before, but he didn't draw any, you know, comparison to that. But I don't know. It's just, I, it's just, maybe you're right that he feels he didn't deserve enough credit, but you cannot, every county is trying to find the balance. There's no such thing as an all-out attack Gaelic football team now, and there never was. Like, I mean, I've played in the half-back line, and if I was, this was back in the 90s, if I was attacking all the time, the cornerback behind me would be telling me, Woolley, come back here, like, give me a bit of cover. There was always a balance between going out and attacking and watching your defence. And, like, even now, like, the likes of Dublin have it down to a T in that they'll commit a lot of bodies to attack, but they'll also get bodies back if you're slow with your, if you're very slow with your build up. There's no such thing as an out and out defensive team, and there's no such thing as an out and out attacking team. Every team is trying to find the balance. And I think Kevin Walsh was obviously on the side of the very defensive side, and Pádraig Joyce would be up around a 7 or an 8 on the attacking side. Like, I mean, Dublin might be about a 6. You know, more attacking towards defending.
I think that's the most pertinent point, way that you made there, the last one. Everybody obviously has to get the balance right between defence and attack. That's clear. But like, then you have philosophies that lean more towards defence.
Yeah, yeah.
And philosophies that lean towards attack. So James Horan, for example, in Mayo, is definitely leaning towards attack.
He's a 7 or an 8 towards the attacking end of the scale. Yeah.
Pádraig Joyce, I would have said at the league, obviously was close enough to that too. Whereas it, you know, in the championship this year, he kind of reverted back towards the median. But I think the examples that Kevin Walsh uses are unfair. You pointed out the Shane Walsh one that was completely isolated. It could have been he just happened to be chasing back at the time. It wasn't Pádraig Joyce wasn't telling Shane Walsh to be constantly back there. And just in defence of Pádraig Joyce this year, he was going into that Mayo game on the back of two games preparation. Into the Connacht final. One of them was a hammering against that Mayo team. Then they didn't get the Sligo game because Sligo had to pull out. So as well as that, he has players that are off form, you know, and then other players that are missing, like Damien Comer came on clearly injured, and he's coming off the back of that Mayo game. And then he's also playing Mayo in Pearse Stadium in wintertime. Yeah. You know, so you have to adapt the conditions. So Pádraig Joyce did that. I think if Pádraig Joyce played Mayo at the height of summer next year, you'd see a completely different Galway, because as we go back to earlier, Pádraig Joyce naturally leans towards the more attacking end of that balance, whereas I would say that Kevin Walsh leaned more towards the defensive side, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's just his philosophy. I would think anyway. Kevin Walsh might dispute that, but there's nothing wrong with it. But as you said, just own it as opposed to trying to explain yourself.
Exactly. There's a big controversy in Clare. So the Sunday Times had this last Sunday. Mick Foley and Dennis Walsh, and a lot of rumours going around down in Clare, and there's WhatsApp messages going around, and there's accusations, and you have, you know, I know Davy Fitzgerald was talking about the online harassment of his father and all these sort of stuff. And now the Sunday Times did an article where, you know, they say that the senior hurling team had to break into Cusick Park for training after they were locked out. These are basically a list of things Brian Lohan has had to contend with. And there's also a controversy about GPS rentals. So here's a few of the issues that Brian Lohan has had to deal with. So the team being locked out of Cusick Park for a training session, Brian Lohan had to pay the strength and conditioning staff after they had gone unpaid by the county board. Brian Lohan sent 29 unanswered emails last year to the county secretary trying to address a number of issues. 29 unanswered emails. The away league game in Wexford, the team stayed in a hotel the night before. The hotel bill wasn't paid by the county board on departure, leaving Brian Lohan to have to chase payment on behalf of the hotel. And number 5, on the same trip, the post-match meal was not paid for and Brian Lowen had to arrange payments himself. Sounds very unprofessional kind of stuff going on here, Conor. And like the Sunday Times has kind of revealed all this. And I'm sure there's going to be an investigation into all of it, because I know Clare has the Aero Club have proposed, and it has been endorsed by the county board, development of a 5-year strategic plan for GEA in Clare. And I suppose when they get to the bottom of all this kind of stuff and this 5-year strategic review, you know, they'll maybe find some sort of a solution, because it seems like it's gone very toxic down there.
Yeah, I mean, there was a few red flags kind of in that report, particularly from Brian Lowen's point of view. I mean, I think Kevin McSay brought up before having to pay for a hotel when he was in charge of Roscommon off his own credit card, and then having to recoup the expenses. Brian Lowen's had to do that a load of times. The 29 emails to the county Pat Fitzgerald is the county secretary. I don't think, you know, the issues between Brian Lowen and Davey have been well documented. And I think there's Pat Fitzgerald was quoted as saying in the report, I think, that their relationship is okay, but there's clearly tension there. And there was kind of just a coverage of the county board meeting that they had virtually last week, and it just sounded very, very tense. Just something is just not right. And on that committee as well, I think the county board has endorsed it all right, but I don't think it's quite got the go ahead yet. I think that the county board are seeking some involvement in it as well, because the members at the moment, I think that they're all kind of high profile business people in Clare with a hurling background, but I don't think they're at the moment, they're independent of the county board, whereas there probably has to be some kind of relationship between them if they're to implement kind of solutions for Clare County Board going forward. So
yeah,
well, overall, I wasn't aware of it until what was going on, until I read the article, and just a load of things having to break into the Cusick Park, was it? And then the GPS stuff as well, which we might get into too, there was a load of things that hinted that there is a lot of stuff that needs to be resolved in Clare at the moment.
Yeah, I'll explain the GPS one, because that's probably the most shocking one, really. And in the investigation that they did in the Sunday Times, there's an allegation that when Brian Lowen tried to cut costs, and his management team met resistance from county board executives. The article says that the county board were paying a massive $18,000 per year to rent a 10-year-old 18-unit GPS system. So 18 units, 18 grand a year. So that's 1,000 a year per unit. And 18 isn't enough for the whole squad, so you'd be sharing them around, right? So it's 1,000 per year and you've no ownership achieved. So all you're doing is renting them. You'll never get to own them. So Brian Lowen, he sourced a world-class system used in professional sport at an average cost of just $375 per unit per year over 3 years. And after the 3 years is up, the system and units would belong to the county board outright in the end. So number one is $1,000 per year per unit, a 10-year-old GPS system, and never own it, versus Brian Lowen sourced $375 per unit over 3 years, and then you own them. And Brian Lowen met resistance from the county board to be able to source these GPS units himself. Like, I mean, it doesn't surprise me. I've been involved in GEA long enough, since I was very young and playing with the county. And you just know, it's just heartbreaking to think that this kind of thing will go on.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that company, Woolley, is StatSports, which are an Irish company. And I'm pretty sure they provide it to, as you said, across a range of sports. But I think Liverpool might use them. I'm pretty sure Liverpool use them as well. So they're obviously kind of world renowned. And an issue I had is that obviously this happens in all counties, not just kind of limited to Clare. But should Brian Lowen be the guy that's, you know, not necessarily, I've no issue with him sourcing them, but like, would the county board not look at that on a balance sheet, say, and let's say we're looking at this, this is costing us 18 grand a year. Should we not be going out there, you know, and seeing can we get a better system, as opposed to Brian Lowen having to do it? But then when presented with a solution that's far cheaper, far better, like why would they reject it? I just can't understand that.
Yeah, well, the big question here is, Conor, and this is what this investigation would probably get to the bottom of, is the person they were renting the 18,000 a year. Is the person that owns those GPSs, is that person in any way connected to the county board? You know what I mean? To want to keep this contract going instead of going for the cheaper, more up-to-date model. So that's the big question. We'll wait and see. Is there a link between that set of GPS trackers versus the new one that Brian Lowen sourced? So I suppose we'll find that out as, you know, the news kind of breaks. The Sunday Times doing some great work on that. All right, we'll leave it there, Connor, and we'll talk to Connor Sweeney next.
I said, are you going to get up or are you going to stay in bed? I said, we have a game there about 3:30. If you wouldn't mind joining us. Didn't even start, like, didn't even go for the bag. Took his line, took his extra 5 minutes. It was like the snooze button. Hit the snooze button for another 5 minutes. Rolled out of bed. 1-7 that day.
So after captaining Tipperary to their first Munster title since 1935, last Friday week, Connor Sweeney deservedly became the third ever football all-star in Tipperary, and he joins us on the line now. Only the third ever, Connor. That's not bad going.
Thanks, Willie. Yeah, no, it's not. There's only three of us, I suppose, so it's kind of it's an elite group at the moment. So yeah, delighted to be part of it now.
Yeah, how did you find out? Because you found out the morning of it. You knew before the show. Now I hope Declan Brown didn't send you a text to ruin it on you like he did for Quinlivan.
No, so the footballers were announced on the Friday morning very early, but I kind of found out unofficially on Thursday evening. I got a phone call of someone else, but it was totally unofficial. I was kind of half waiting in for an official phone call, but it never came. But I was delighted to wake up Friday morning. So essentially I found out officially the same as ever. That was how it really all came about.
And you were very, very strong favourite to win it, but were you thinking like that, or were you just thinking something might happen here?
That's right. I think the All-Stars most years are kind of predictable. You know, you kind of know if you're in with a good shout, and I suppose the year we're after having collectively and personally, I knew I was in with a shout. So, it was nice to wake up to it on Friday morning, I must say, but like, you know yourself, they can be quite predictable some years, and you know when you're in with a good shout, and I suppose I had a fair idea, all right, yeah.
Yeah, no, you definitely did. Come here, where have you got your Munster final jersey? Because I hope you have it in a safe somewhere in case it's not robbed. Your captain, your man of the match, it's the first Munster title since 1935, like I mentioned. It's the bloody Sunday anniversary. It's the special jerseys. This could be make you a millionaire someday.
Oh, Jesus, yeah, it would be grand, wouldn't it? €1 million, but I know it's at home, right? It's kept fairly safe now at the minute. I've all the lad's signatures on it, so yeah, it'll take pride of place now. Someday I must get a framed and things, but it's definitely safe for now.
I was reading a quote from yours talking about the jerseys and the emotion of the Munster final and everything, and you were talking about being conscious of the occasion and all the history around it, but as players we had to park it. We had a match to go out and win. And I think you made a speech after the Limerick game, you know, to kind of dampen all that kind of emotion down.
I suppose when we found out there's Cork in the Munster final and things, and we hadn't played well in the semi-final, all of a sudden, you know, all these things were coming out in the media about these new jerseys and things, and you know, it was sprung on us really. We didn't really have time to think about it, but I know I just didn't want the lads to be sidetracked on these kind of small things that really didn't matter, to be honest with you. I mean, there was only one thing that mattered to us, and that was actually getting our hands on the Munster medal. So yeah, we put it to bed on the first session back, and to be fair to the boys, we reacted really well after that, and we got 2 good weeks of training. But yeah, those small things can really affect your performance if you let them, but we nipped it in the bud early. So we got it out of the way nice and early, and we focused on the football from there on out, thank God.
Yeah, focused on the training. But I remember I probably got it wrong on the Thursday. I was saying, right, you know, it's best practice for top-level sportsmen not to use emotion, because I obviously understand it, that you can't depend on emotion for every game, so it's not best practice. But I was saying on the Thursday, of all days to tap into the emotion of Blundy Sunday and everything, this is the day to do it. And I don't think he did do it, listening from your interviews.
Collectively, we wouldn't have kind of, it's not really something we would have, like you said, depended on for motivation or whatever, because
yeah.
I mean, so I suppose it was only our second Munster final appearance in about that decade, like, you know, so, and for the majority of the guys on the panel last year, it was their first outing in a Munster final. So, like, we didn't have to dig too deep for motivation. I mean, we were kind of starved of success at that level for a long, long time. So, like, you know, the likes of myself and other senior players, we definitely didn't have to dig too deep, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We were in a Munster final against a team that we've always kind of been very competitive with. So we kind of fancied our chances. So, like, tapping into it kind of wasn't really an option from a player's perspective. Now, I'm sure when you're in the heat of a battle, all right, and you know, Munster final morning approaches, you do kind of, you think about it slightly, but 'tis only really after when we had actually won the match that we kind of, we reflected on the weekend that it was, and then it kind of hits home. But yeah, we were kind of conscious of not getting sidetracked with the whole commemoration weekend and things. And yeah, I think we got it fairly spot on now, to be fair.
Yeah, you definitely, was it weird looking around at a completely different coloured jersey, even on the pitch?
Yeah, that was another thing we addressed early on. We actually had wore that jersey a number of times in training in the lead up to the match, so we kind of had familiarised ourselves with it a little bit. But
right.
At the very initially, it was a little bit strange. Yeah, like, I mean, it couldn't have been any more contrasting to our normal jersey, so it was a little bit weird. And that was something I was kind of a little bit apprehensive about at the start as well, just changing jersey completely. Like, you know, we've always worn the blue and gold. But I suppose, listen, it all worked out well. I mean, if we had lost the game and we performed poorly, you might be looking at these things as maybe distractions. But listen, all's well that ends well, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it definitely did end well. Like I said, you were man of the match and captain. And you made a brilliant speech, I have to say, even though it was an empty stadium. But it looked like you actually put a bit of thought into the speech.
Yeah, well, obviously, yeah, I suppose, to be honest with you, I hadn't thought about it too much. Again, it's kind of something you try not to focus on in the lead up to a big game. But like, I knew that if, you know, if we were to win, that I'd obviously have to say some few words. But I had nothing written down or anything like that. I kind of winged it, to be honest with you. But
right.
There was a few things in my head that I kind of made priority to get in there. So yeah, I don't know. You just kind of, emotion takes over then, and you just kind of take off. And to be honest with you, I can't remember most of it, to be honest. But yeah, hopefully it wasn't too bad anyway.
Well, no, it was very good, and it was just natural. It didn't really look like you would have prepared, but I'm sure you had in your head. It's always a difficulty for captains, obviously. You want to give the speech the respect it deserves, but if you focus on it, you're not thinking about the match, and it is a difficult thing for a captain to have to deal with.
Yeah, it is, and I wouldn't be the person now who'd like to sit down, you know, in the lead up to the match and have my speech prepared, because I don't know, like, it just, I wouldn't feel I'd be preparing right that kind of way, you know, I'm thinking of the wrong things, whereas, I just said, like, look, if we do happen to win, I'll sort it out in the few minutes that I have, and yeah, it was grand, it was fine.
Talk to us about Colin O'Riordan's return for the final, Conor, because I think he was interviewed afterwards, and I think, did he approach you and one or two other players asking you, would it be okay, as if that was a difficult question for you boys to answer?
Yeah, no, what do you mean? Did he approach us and ask us if it was okay to play, was it?
Yeah, would anybody be put out if he came, or what your thoughts on it were?
Sure, I suppose, yeah, like David, the manager, just would have spoken to a few of us, and he would have just put it to us saying, like, listen, like, you know, what would be your thoughts? I think there was a few senior players, he said it to, what would your thoughts be on Colin playing? And sure, like, we were all thinking along the same wavelength. Like, I mean, he was absolutely, we'd love to have him playing. Like, he would have been some asset to us, and that's the way it turned out. So from a player's perspective, like, you know, we didn't have any issues with it, obviously, because we knew how good he was. And obviously someone was going to miss out, which was tough. But I mean, you know, there was a Munster final there to be won. And like, if, you know, this was just one of those things we had to do. And, you know, like, from our perspective, like, we were always going to do it, you know, and it worked out fairly well, to be fair. So I don't think anyone can have too many complaints, really.
Isn't it a bonkers year, really, when you think about it, that Colin would never have been playing if it wasn't for COVID. Michael Quinlivan and Liam Casey would have been away travelling if it wasn't for COVID. Cork completely unexpectedly knock out Kerry. It's the bloody Sunday anniversary. Like, I mean, the stars kind of aligned for you, didn't they?
Oh, they really did, yeah. It was a really funny year, but it's gas. Like, I kind of, I smelled something in the air during the first lockdown, I just got this weird feeling that it was going to be one of those years.
Really?
And we, and I said it to a couple of people. I said it to even a member of management. We were speaking during the first lockdown, and we put massive emphasis on training during the first lockdown, individual training, like getting a good base level of fitness into us. And so when we returned, you know, we at least we'd have a good base level of fitness so we could focus on the football side of things. And it turned out that that was really important because we only had 4 weeks collective training before the last two league games. So we returned in decent shape, and that definitely stood to us. So, yeah, it was definitely a bonkers year. Like, you know, Michael, obviously, the travelling brought him home, and it kept Liam Casey around as well. And obviously Colin Story, and like they were three massive players for us throughout the course of the season. So, yeah, it was really funny. The stars seemed to align for us, and geez, thankfully they did. And like, you know, this year of all years, like you couldn't write it, Colin, really.
No.
It was a fairy tale year now, to be fair.
It was, because I can only imagine the honour of being given the captaincy, and then you see like Quinlivan and Casey, who are so important, and you say, oh shit, now they're going to be travelling, you know, the year. Like you must have been deflated going into the year before it all started, you know, working out all right.
I wouldn't say we were deflated, because down through the years, we've always kind of, there's always been someone potentially who could start for us or be involved with us that's not available for some right. reason or another, through injury or through, you know, going to Australia or going traveling or just injury. Like there's always been people who haven't been available to us that would have been fantastic players. So it wasn't anything out of the ordinary to us really, but like obviously not having Michael available was massive, you know, he was such a big player for us. But yeah, like it was just like, I mean, like we weren't in a great position going into the lockdown in the league, you know, we had played 5 matches and we'd only 3 points on the board, so we were in relegation trouble. So yeah. The last two league games for us on return, you know, you talk about winning a Munster Championship being important, like if we didn't win our last two league games, we would have been relegated to Division 4, you know, and that would have been catastrophic for football in the county. So those two league games were extremely important for us to retain our Division 3 status. And the knock-on effect of winning those two games is you're going into the first round of the championship, you know, with a couple of wins under your belt, and you have a bit of momentum and confidence, and we never look back after that. So, yeah, the year just worked out really well for us, you know, to be honest.
Yeah, no, it definitely did. Like you said, you're putting it down to the bit of training you did maybe in the lockdown that you were able to come back a different, you know, a different team.
Yeah. Well, that's one factor, I suppose.
One factor, yeah.
I just found, you know, when we returned, okay, we had two winnable games in Offaly and Leitrim in the league, and that obviously helps when you're returning to two games that you're looking to win. But I just found that, like, compared to those two teams, we were probably just a little bit fitter and stronger in the final quarters of those games, and we seed them out well. And against Clare in the first round of the championship, we just seemed to be on it a little bit more. So, yeah, I during lockdown, but also concentration levels and return as well, so it's a number of factors really, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it probably is. Come here, I want to ask you about the sideline against Limerick. Like, I mean, there's 30 seconds left in the game, you look like you were going out, it's on your wrong side. Did anyone else put up their hand for this, or was this thrown into your lap?
Yeah, I can remember it very clearly, actually. It's strange how clearly I remember it, and there's not a whole pile to it from my point of view. Like, I just remember the ref awarding the free from out by the sideline, and I knew Jack Kennedy had gone off the field. He went off with a hamstring injury. Like, that was Jack's side. It would have been his free to take.
Right.
But he was gone, and Michael hadn't taken frees in over a year, so he wasn't really an option, even though he probably fancied himself, but he was actually injured at the time. So, yeah, I just went over and I said, I'm having this. And I just remember looking at the clock, and there was about 30 seconds left, and I just said, I fancy this here, like, you know. And I just went over, and the rest was history, really. I had no intention of going short, or I had no intention of passing it. It's funny, the conditions, I've said this before as well, the conditions were actually favourable. I know it might sound silly, but the wind was at my back, and it was quite a strong breeze. So I knew if I just put it far enough right that the wind would take it in, and thankfully it did. And like, it was a matter of inches, really, because it came off the post. But yeah, really happy with it. Struck it really well, and the minute I left my boot, I knew it was going over. You know, so
really, because I was thinking, because it was such a good strike, it would have gone over another 20 meters back, that you'd hit it maybe too well, and if you hit it too well, it won't drop back down, and it almost went the other side of the post.
Yeah, sure. Like, you know, you talked about fine margins in sport. Like, I mean, the width of the post there kept us in the championship, and look what happened after that. It's mad, really, when you think about it. But
Yeah, it was one of those where like I wouldn't take it on if I didn't feel I was able to score. But it's not something I'd be practicing a whole pile. You'd have the odd go at it, right? But I don't know. I just felt really confident at the time, and I just could see myself putting it over, really. And it is mad what a bit of visualisation can do. And yeah, thankfully it went over, and I.
Yeah, and come here, the loss against Mayo, would that, like, when you look back on the year, like, I'm sure you're looking, I don't want to put a dampener on the year or anything, but, like, I mean, you're Munster champions. Did the loss against Mayo, I don't know, sour it some little bit?
I don't think it soured it, but you'd probably look at it as, an opportunity lost again. I mean, like, listen, they were the better team on the day. There's no doubt about that. Like, they were just on it way more than we were, and they deserved to win. But we would just be very disappointed with a few aspects of the game. I mean, we got two early chances in the first few minutes, and they fell to the two right lads. We just didn't take them. So, you know, Michael and myself would be very disappointed with them. And then we concede four goals in the first half, which you just can't do, like, against a top team. And Mayo were just ruthlessly efficient on the day, to be fair. You know, I don't think they had a wide in the first half. And that was the difference between the two teams. They wanted it more than we did, and they took their chances. We didn't, and you know, that's the difference. But it was very disappointing on the day, obviously. And I mean, the dressing room at half time now was a tough place to be, you know, like, that was one of the toughest places I've ever been with a team. But we rallied in the second half, and you know, we did a little bit better. But yeah, like, it definitely, it doesn't put a damper on the year, but when you look back at that specific game on its own, it's definitely probably an opportunity that has slipped by, you know. So, yeah, but listen, it's over now. There's not much we can do about it now, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, well, that's the thing. And, like, obviously the amount of goals you missed, and your second, you know, you can point to that. You can point to how you rallied in the second half. You can point to Declan Brown joining the backroom team. You know, there's plenty of things to be positive. Yeah. You know, loads of things to be positive about going into this year.
Oh God, there is, yeah, like, there is, to be fair. And we were expecting a fairly quick turnaround from last season. It's obviously played a little bit now, but hopefully we'll be back training in the next 4 weeks. But listen, there's plenty to be positive about. You know, we're in Division 3 again. You know, that must be our first goal, is to try and get out of Division 3 and up to 2, because I think we're more than capable of competing up there. So that would be that would be a long-term goal of this year, definitely. And listen, there's a Munster Championship there as well to be tackled. So yeah, there's plenty to be looking forward to. Declan is involved now in the backroom team, so he'll bring his own bit of experience and knowledge there. And we have a couple of younger players and older players indeed back involved again this year. So yeah, things aren't looking too bad now. But listen, we have a bit of a target on our back now this year, as you will know, going forward. So we'll have to deal with that as well. So yeah, it's exciting now, to be fair.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Before you go, are you captain again this year, or has that been announced?
Jesus, I actually don't know, to be honest with you. I don't think we've had any conversation with that yet. So we just have to wait and see, I suppose, when we get back. I haven't spoken to David about that or anything like that. So who knows? God only knows what will happen, but sure.
Yeah, if he says nothing, then you're just defaulted as captain anyway. So listen, just don't answer the phone.
Yeah, just Put don't answer on the screen. Roll over.
Come here, before I let you go, you're back teaching. Finally, Jesus! Like, I mean, you have a great union. That's all I say. You're back in class. So I'm going to have to let you go. You're back in teaching the 6 years.
Yeah, we're back this week now. It's just 6 years in the school, so it's fairly quiet now at the moment. Actually, there's only 6 years around. But listen, it seems to be a step in the right direction. Anyway, I think the 5th years are due back in a couple of weeks, and then that'll take us up to Easter break, and then all secondary school students are scheduled back after the Easter break. So listen, fingers crossed it goes ahead, because if it does, then more things might open up and we might get back to normality some bit. But yeah, that's the crack for now, back in the classroom, thank God.
Brilliant stuff. Come here, Connor, thanks very much for taking the call. I'll let you back to class.
No problem, Willie. Mind yourself, good luck.
And when I started running, I suppose I didn't stop, and when I got the chance to go, I said I'd stay going, so it opened up.
We're only the small little fish out there, so we are, and we're trying hard to make it through, but it's hard to get the breaks when you're the smaller fish.
Because I love this county so much, you know, and it's just, I'm delighted that the lads did it for the people of Waterford today, because, like, I'm heartbroken.